This week on Retronauts, we are all tuna heads.
You're listening to a podcast about old video games, so I have to assume that you sometimes find yourself facing the same dilemma that I do. You just don't have enough money to buy old games and still afford new releases. It's a good thing we have Gamefly. It's the best way to rent all your favorite games, and buy them too if you like. At Gamefly.com, you can pick your favorite games and have them mailed directly to your door. It's the leading video game rental service, and it offers more than 9,000 titles to choose from. Plus, they offer movie rentals now, too. So you can try out interesting games and movies before you buy them, or you can just rent a favorite in perpetuity, since Gamefly allows you to keep a game rental for as long as you like. That means there are no late fees, and you can cancel at any time. So go to gamefly.com/retronauts and start your free premium 30-day trial today. The premium trial allows you to check out two games and or movies at a time. You can only get this offer by visiting gamefly.com/retronauts. So diversify your gaming budget by signing up today and start playing all your favorite games absolutely free for 30 days.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Retronauts. I'm your host for this week, Bob Mackey, and today's episode is all about Maniac Mansion, one of my favorite games of all time. We did a Maniac Mansion episode in 2012 for 1UP, but that was an interview episode with Ron Gilbert, and that was great, but I wanted to do a dedicated, you know, regular Retronauts about this game and why it's great and what it influenced. So before I get started, let's see who's here today in the room. Who's across from me?
C'est moi, Jeremy Parrish.
Jeremy Parrish is here, and this is apparently the one adventure game Jeremy has played.
Yes.
Okay.
It's the only one that is interesting.
It is one of the most interesting adventure games. I won't say it's the only one that is interesting, but we'll talk more about that later. Who else is here today?
This is Michael Raparez of Vigigame Apocalypse.
And Michael, what are your feelings on Maniac Mansion?
I enjoyed it. I hadn't actually played it before you tapped me for this.
So we're getting some new perspective. This is great.
Yeah. But, I mean, it kind of is a refreshing thing to go back and play. I think it holds up remarkably well.
It really does, yeah. Well, we'll talk more about it later. Yeah. But, yeah, I feel like it has aged incredibly well. And who else is here with us today? A new guest, first time. Well, not a first time guest, but maybe first time for our independent run.
First time for the independent run. I'm Phil Kohler from Polygon. And I'm glad we're here to replace the Ron Gilbert episode. What does Ron Gilbert know about Maniac Mansion?
That guy is always
certainly
showing
less
up
than
here.
Me.
He's forgotten everything.
He's always showing up
to know.
Saying, yeah. Ask me about Loom.
I mean, I think I've talked too much to Ron Gilbert in my life. I think it's time to cool off a little bit, but Ron Gilbert's great. And I have an entire a really in-depth interview about his career on US Gamer when I was still there. It's one of the things I'm really proud of. But Phil and I have a secret history together in that Phil and I were going for the same job at 1UP in 2008.
Yeah, which I didn't know until 2 months ago when you told me.
Yeah, I told you that. I guess we were finalists for the same job. So Phil got the job.
It wasn't a very good job and I didn't keep it for very long, if that makes you feel better.
Well, Phil was briefly my enemy for about 3 months and then I cooled off. I was like, who's this Phil Kohler guy? He thinks he's better than me. But then so my history of not being employed by 1UP is like – Phil beat me in 2008. Frank Cifaldi beat me in 2010. But in 2011, I don't know who I beat, but apparently I was number one. And then I had a job for all of 18 months. So
that's longer than I had mine.
That's pretty long for any for any games journalism job, frankly. We're not here to talk about the state of games journalism. We're here to talk about Maniac Mansion, much more exciting than that.
Bob, has Ron Gilbert adopted you as his godson yet?
No, but I really want to go on a camping trip or something. I feel like he's my
maybe
adventure
like
game
a drum
dad.
Circle.
Yeah, like we can talk about design. We're buddies on Twitter. I mean, me and Ron Gilbert go back at least 5 years. We're buds. I hope he doesn't hear this and get creeped out, by the way. But so before I start, I wanted to talk about the history of adventure games prior to Maniac Mansion. In order to understand why Maniac Mansion is so great, you have to see what came before. It's sort of like if you sit down and watch Citizen Kane without knowing what came before it, you'll be like, why does everybody care about this movie? But if you look at the state of motion pictures before that movie, you can see why Citizen Kane was so ahead of its time. And I feel like – I'm not going to say this is the Citizen Kane adventure game.
I feel like
games journalists either say it's the Citizen Kane of something or the Dark Souls of something. But we're going to try to avoid that.
Is there a Citizen Kane of Dark Souls yet?
That's Dark Souls 1, I think, is the Citizen Kane of Dark Souls. But yeah, I want to talk about just the brief history of adventure games. So I think the first first known adventure game on computers, like the first adventure video game, was definitely 1976's Colossal Cave. This was one of those adventure games you had to play at a very expensive workstation at a college university. So this was not played by a lot of people. It was like if you were like an engineering student or you had access to one of these workstations, you would play a game like Colossal Cave, and it was a very rudimentary adventure game.
Well, it was just something that like the students had built on this system they had access to. It's like, well, we got some downtime. Let's amuse ourselves.
And I feel like that was kind of the state of most games on computers for a long time. It's like we built this computer for work, but we snuck a game onto it because we're humans and we like to play.
Yeah, Colossal Cave Adventure was created by William Crowther, who was a guy who liked spelunking and going into caverns and exploring in real life. And he said, basically, like, let's take the actual layout of Mammoth Cave and turn it into a video game. And then people started adding in adventure game elements and like points and puzzles and quests.
So it was a kind of a collaborative thing then.
Yeah, I mean, most it was a mainframe game, and all of those back then, it was like people would do something and then other people would add to it. Like Space War started out as just like a simple shooter, and then some people added some gravity and they added like a star background and so on and so forth. So yeah, it was always kind of this collaborative thing. Zork was the same way. It was also collaborative.
And Zork is next on the list. I mean, first we have so that is the workstation environment. That's a workstation game. So beginning to home PCs, some important adventure games are Mystery House by Online Systems, later Sierra Online. It is the first it's a text adventure, but you get some nice, in quotes, graphics with that. So basically you just get a static screen of really rudimentary graphics. But in 1980, that was something amazing for what most people would play as a text adventure, just seeing a scene in front of you.
It had the finest stick figures that 1980 graphics could
Those were some pretty great stick figures, pretty terrifying murder scenes drawn with those.
Yeah.
We also have Zork, which Jeremy mentioned, by Infocom. That's another text adventure, and I think it's probably the first great and first notable text adventure game. I've never played it. I think
what?
I've never played Zork. I don't know.
Really?
It's hard for me to go back to text adventure games.
I've tried doing it, and I
just don't know. Maybe I need the right one to do it. I don't know.
Zork is the right one.
It is. I think you would appreciate its very dry sense of humor.
Interesting. Okay, Phil, how do you feel about text adventures? I'm just curious. Like, I have a problem. I need graphics or something to like. I mean, I read a lot of books, so I don't know what my problem is. But,
sure. Yeah, I've never like completed Zork, but I've gone back and like. It's just one of those things that I'm like, I feel like I need to at least experience it. So yeah. I've gone back and like jumped in. The thing with a lot of, especially the older text adventures like Zork is that they're so, I mean, I guess this is true of the adventure game genre in general and something we'll talk about with Maniac Mansion. But like it's so easy to screw up and die.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
That I think I gave up pretty fast.
I feel like Zork is fairly forgiving. There aren't that many ways to die.
I found all of them.
So. Oh, congratulations on that. I mean, it's no Shadowgate.
That's true.
No, that
That's
game was
true.
All about killing
I mean,
you.
To be fair, I played Zork 1, which was, I think, a retooled version that came free with not Zork Inquisitor, but the FMV Zork game.
The FMV Zork.
Oh,
yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Oh, God, man. That thing had a weird...
When the Zork franchise really
Yeah, when they tried to
up.
Reboot it.
Look forward to our Zork episode. I think we should do one. But so we have, you
I
know...
I just made a note to do one next
oh, cool.
episode.
Nice.
Or next section.
So
next session.
Colossal Cave, Mystery House, Zork. The next big one, 84, is King's Quest by Sierra Online. So this game looked great for the time, and you had direct control over your character with the arrow keys on the keyboard. And the game still acted as a text adventure in a way in that you would have to type in commands and things like that. So this was kind of like the most common form of adventure game, especially for Sierra Online. They would not get into point-and-click adventures until the late 80s, early 90s. And the next super amazing and great and influential adventure game is Deja Vu, originally for the Macintosh. And it kind of invented the point-and-click interface. I mean, it looks kind of weird now because it's just like Macintosh OS windows that are popping up around a screen.
It's built in HyperCard.
Exactly.
I don't think it is.
Oh, really?
Wasn't it?
I don't believe so.
Huh.
Oh, okay. We just did a Mac episode on the east side of the country, and I'm pretty sure it was not done in HyperCard. But I could see where – actually, HyperCard came later actually.
Oh, okay.
Myst was made in HyperCard. Correctly.
But whatever it was delivered via, I mean, this was great because you have the point-and-click interface. There was no more guesswork in what is this item in front of me? What did the developers name it? You click on an item in the background. You click verbs. You have an inventory that's like physically represented on the screen as, you know, like bullet lists of items. Like, it really was a forward-thinking game, and there's also a great NES port. So these are all the things leading up to Maniac Mansion, all the influences and everything that came before.
I think worth mentioning, maybe not as a direct influence, but is the sort of Japanese adventure game scene that developed. I think the most notable release was the Portopia serial murder case.
That's
by
right.
Yuji Horii, who would go on to create Dragon Quest.
Was that 84, 85?
That was 84, 85 yeah. on PCs, and then it made it to Famicom, I want to say, in 1985. Mm. But that was kind of important because it took the PC game adventure game concept and came up with like a streamlined interface
yeah,
that would work with two buttons and a D-pad. And like I feel like the popularity of that game did a lot to kind of sort of make adventure games on consoles very popular in Japan, which you know it would result in Maniac Mansion, I think, account for a lot of its success on consoles and the fact that it had – you know, the Famicom port that we'll talk about later.
Yeah, I mean, that's not a great example of a good port, but we'll talk more about that later.
It does provide some context, though.
Yeah, of course.
There must be like a good fan translation of that game.
Yeah, definitely.
Point, right?
Yeah,
because I've always meant to like – I feel like it's something I should go check out because I've read a lot about it but never actually tried it. If there's a fan translation, I should look that up.
There definitely is.
Do this.
Have you seen screenshots of it, Phil?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's pretty hideous. But
yeah.
Let's talk about – so this is a Lucasfilm Games game. Before the company was called LucasArts, you know, when they were – what do you call that when a company reorganizes or whatever? Yeah, that happened in like 1990. But for – when they were born, they were called Lucasfilm Games. And they started as a division of the Lucasfilm Computer Division, which would eventually become Pixar. And what, did George Lucas sell that off to like pay alimony or to pay for Howard the Duck debts or something? I forget what the story is behind that.
Probably.
But I know like they originally owned Pixar or what would become Pixar, and they were sold off for some reason. I should have done more research on this, but I know that Lucasfilm Game was a division of the company that would eventually become Pixar.
Yeah, I mean there's so much stuff that kind of came out of Lucasfilm and ILM. Pixar and Adobe Photoshop has its origins in Lucasfilm, LucasArts, or whatever.
So it was founded in 1982, and for the most part, when they first started, they were originally known for action games that revolved around some sort of graphical gimmick. So we have like things like Ball Blazer, mm-hmm. Rescue on Fractalis, mm-hmm. Coronis Rift, and the Eidolon. And a lot of these were just like, we're going to kind of fake 3D in a way that looks very convincing. I mean, it moves at about 4 frames per second, but that's enough for the early 80s to get you on board.
Yeah, I think Rescue on Fractalis was a like procedurally generated game before those were things,
I don't remember, but I know what people always remember about that is like when you land, you have to land to pick up to rescue people, and occasionally one of the people you rescue will be an alien. It will just pop up on your windscreen and just smash it and your game will end. So a lot of people who grew up in that era now have night terrors because of this game. So their first adventure game was actually 1986, Labyrinth. It was based on the Jim Henson movie, and I played this game, and it's not super great, but it is inspired in some way. It has a fun like Wizard of Oz style opening in that the game opens as a text adventure game in which you are going to the movies. And once you buy your ticket and get popcorn and stuff and sit down, David Bowie appears on the movie screen and you are sucked into the labyrinth. And basically the only goal is like escape in 13 hours. And there's no there's nothing told to you outside of that. Like in King's Quest, you have direct control of your character. And you have like drop-down menu of verbs and your inventory and stuff like that. But it is a very confusing game. I mean, it is taking place in the labyrinth, but it's mainly like just try everything, go everywhere. The backgrounds are just like a bunch of brick walls with doors in them. It's sort of a very confusing game. I couldn't really get into it.
I do love the idea of like starting as a text adventure and then turning into something like that's cool.
So that's a really cool idea. Yeah.
It's not directly based on the movie. Like you don't play as Sarah, right?
Right.
No, you choose a boy or a girl and then your favorite color. And your color actually – I think it's the color of the character's shirt, but it also influences other things that happen in the game.
And the game doesn't actually begin until you type the input command like please take this child away.
I don't think that happens.
Yeah.
And there's no Jennifer Connelly. No. But that's in the Famicom version, which is also not very fun.
It's sort of like Purple Rose of Cairo or something. You go to the movies and Jareth starts talking directly to you and brings you inside the labyrinth. And then it's also cool because it it has a bunch of joke endings that you can do. Like,
oh, really?
You can turn his spells back on him and it fries his hair and he's like, oh, well, I guess I have to let you go now. So
he loses that cool like 80s soccer mom do.
Yeah. Well, he refuses to let you win at the end. And so like you can do a bunch of things and like regardless of what you do, you've won the game. But now it's just like, will you turn him into a frog? Will you yeah.
I think I did play this for US Gamer on a live stream. That's probably still up if you want to see me getting confused and quitting about halfway through. But if you want to see where the sort of early roots of LucasArts adventure games come from, this is a good place to start just to play around with it. You probably won't have a lot of fun. Time to get into the actual production of Maniac Mansion, and I have to say a lot of this comes from Ron Gilbert's presentation at GDC 2011. He gave an hour-long talk. It's super in-depth. You can always go back to our 2012 Retronauts episode too. There's a lot of great information there, but a lot of this comes from both of those sources. But I do want to reiterate a lot of this because it is important as to you know how this game was created. So, of course, we have Ron Gilbert and Gary Winnick are the co-designers. Gary Winnick was mostly doing art for this game. And we also have programmers David Fox and Chip Morningstar who developed the Scum Engine alongside Ron Gilbert. We'll talk more about that later. But this this game started as a concept without a story or a genre attached. Ron Gilbert and Gary Winnick were inspired by sort of comedy slash horror movies like The Fly, Reanimator, and Creepshow, and specifically the Stephen King segment with the meteor where Stephen King plays a hillbilly and a meteor lands in his backyard. And I think he's just slowly turns into a plant creature over the course of the 20-minute thing. Have you guys seen Creepshow? It's great.
Yeah.
You're selling me on it.
So. It has a rare instance of Leslie Nielsen playing a villain.
Ooh.
Pre-Naked Gun Leslie Nielsen, he tries to kill – well, he does kill – spoilers. He kills Ted Danson for sleeping with his wife. He buries him alive underwater. So if you want to see Leslie – the most sinister Leslie Nielsen you've ever seen in your life, I recommend watching Creepshow. So Gilbert basically had this idea for the game. He didn't know what to do with it, like what genre is this? What are we going to do with Maniac Mansion? And he figured it out when he went home for the holidays and a young cousin was playing King's Quest. And Ron Gilbert's like, oh, this looks cool. I'll try it for myself. And he kind of hated it because he as we all agree at this point in our lives, at this point in history, it's not fair that you have to guess the verb the developer wants you to use or you have to guess – you know, the noun, like what is this thing on the screen? And he was like, why – I can see this bush on the screen. Why can't I just click on the bush instead of guessing is it a bush? Is it a thicket? Is it this? Is it that? Like how – like I just want to make this simpler. And that's sort of where the genesis of Maniac Mansion came from. But this is an interesting case of design coming out of a sort of not in negative terms but ignorance because Gary and Ron had never designed a game before and they never designed an adventure game before and they didn't really play adventure games. So a lot of the ambition of Maniac Mansion came from them not knowing what they couldn't do and that's why the game took a long time to develop. So there's some interesting stuff I watched in Ron's GDC chat. This game was originally going to start kids like the Goonies or something like that, but they wanted to skew a little older in terms of their audience. And one of the more important things to come out of Maniac Mansion was the Scum Engine. And as we all know, of course, that's Scum stands for Script Creation Utility for Maniac Mansion. And the main value of this is that it allowed for improvisational design. Instead of coding in code, you can code in a much easier to implement scripting language. So if you have an idea, you can throw it into the game almost instantly and then see the results. And that's sort of how really Monkey Island came to be, just them meeting for lunch, coming up with jokes and immediately implementing them in the game because Monkey Island started as a semi-serious game, but just this improvisational atmosphere behind it really helped influence it more towards comedy. But this is where the hamster in the microwave came from. It was sort of a joke that they put in to make Ron Gilbert laugh, like, hey, look what we did in 5 minutes. And then it was part of the game forever, even the NES version. So the mansion itself is based on the main house of the Skywalker Ranch. as sort of a joke because there's a main house and there's a stable house, and the games team worked on a stable house, and they would always have a lot of inside jokes about what was happening in the main house because it was very secretive. So if you look at an image of the Skywalker Ranch, you will immediately think of the Maniac Mansion. There are many elements of inside the mansion, like the spiral staircase, like the media room, that are drawn directly from the Skywalker Ranch. And that is still in operation, right? That's still like the archival place for Star Wars goodies and whatnot.
I've been out there actually, and the thing that I remember most about it is that we went to see a screening of a movie for press, and this other couple like parked next to us, got out of their car, and like they had their dog with them, and they let the dog out, let it have a drink of water, and security guard came up and was like, "I'm sorry, there's no dogs allowed here. You're going to have to leave."
Trespassers will be mutilated.
No. He'll just stay in the car. No, I'm sorry. No exceptions. You're going to have to leave right
now. Wow. So tight security there.
Yeah. What movie were you seeing?
It was The Square, about the protests at Tahrir Square in Egypt.
Oh,
anyway.
Wow. Interesting. So you had not played Maniac Mansion before that?
I had not,
okay,
no.
So you would not have made the connection.
So it didn't strike that chord of recognition.
So like a lot of games of this era, it was kind of designed on paper. They had like a kind of like a map the size of this table and layers of acetate that they would pull down over the rooms that had various item descriptions and, you know, puzzle pathways and various like character pathways and things like that that they would pull down. So a lot of the game was actually developed on paper, which is really interesting. I don't think that happens a lot anymore these days, although I could be surprised. I know when talking to the project codename Steam, is that the name of the game?
Mm-hmm.
Intelligent Systems was saying they prototype a lot of things on paper, which is pretty cool. So the original version –
it makes for better art books, you know, 20 years later.
Yeah, it does. It's like, here's my drawing of this sexy Fire Emblem character. Everybody loves those.
Please look at my sheet of waifus.
So the original version came out in 1987 for the Commodore 64. This game saw a lot of other versions like Apple II, Atari ST, Amiga, Mac. But the most popular version has to be the NES version. The NES had a gigantic install base, but B, this game also had a Nintendo Power cover, which was like money in the bank. I think you probably sold like 250K just by having a Nintendo Power cover.
Yeah, at what point did Nintendo Power covers stop selling games? Because Metal Storm was on NES, Nintendo Power, and that game didn't get produced in large quantities and now is extremely expensive. So there was a drop-off at some point. But I think Maniac Mansion was still like just at the cusp.
Maybe those first 20 issues were the ones that really sold the games, I think.
I think in Maniac Mansion's case, it also helped that was published with like a walkthrough.
That's
Nintendo true.
Nintendo
Power
yeah.
like telling you everything that you could do. And so like now I kind of feel like I did play the game at the time just from reading that, but
I think I did too. It didn't tell you everything. I think it told you about like half of the puzzles like or gave you hints for half of them. But I bring this up a lot on PC episodes we do. I feel like it's hard to remember, but computers were not like this ever-present thing in the household until probably the mid-90s. I mean, I knew people that had computers, but it was basically like this is my dad's computer for his work. And we were allowed to put some games on it. It's not like this is the family computer unless you were rich and I didn't really know any rich people. But so like for the most part, kids in this NES demographic did not play adventure games, did not know what they were. So this was sort of their first and really my first experience with adventure games. So it's time to move on to talking about the actual game. I've been monologuing too much about all these facts. I thought it was important to get all these out. So let's talk about our history with the game. Phil, how about you?
Sure. So I definitely I had the NES version. I don't think I owned it, but I rented it from the local video store fairly regularly. And it was one of those games that I rented a lot because I could never quite get it. I didn't understand it. So every time I rented it, I was like, this time I'm going to figure it out.
Did you understand like the basic pointing and clicking? Like what
part
did you
I guess it was because it was so different from every other NES game that I was playing.
That's true. It really is.
You know, like it wasn't a platformer. It wasn't an action game. And I was still young enough at that point. Like I was probably 6 years old or something. And I didn't get it. Like I didn't understand what I was supposed to be, what my goal was.
There was a lot of reading involved in that game too.
Yeah, definitely.
Maybe not all words six-year-olds can understand, like radioactive and things like that.
But so I don't think I ever like really made I don't think I ever beat the NES version. I don't think I ever finished it. I also didn't have the Nintendo Power walkthrough or anything like that or access to walkthroughs. But I did I distinctly remember many years later when I was probably like 13 or 14 or 15 and I had a computer finally, finding a PC version and finding a walkthrough online and playing through it with a walkthrough just so that I could finally be like, okay, no, I've completed this game now. I know what this is.
You've conquered the demons of your past.
Yeah,
what did you think about it after sort of approaching it as a teenager, getting a better sense of the design? I assume you might have played more adventure games after that or
I definitely gotten more into adventure games and also just had a broader knowledge of games in general and of like the different things that games can do beyond just like action games and platformers. So I appreciated it a lot more. I think I played it back to back with Day of the Tentacle.
Oh, okay.
And so like in my mind I'm always like, well, Day of the Tentacle was a lot better. But
I like it more, but we'll talk more about that later.
Yeah, we'll talk more about that later.
I have so much to say. I wrote like 40,000 words for Day. I think I've written more than any other human about Day of the Tentacle. But Michael, how about you? What's your experience with Maniac Mansion?
Well, again, I did read the Nintendo Power feature. And I think I thought a lot about Maniac Mansion when I was a kid. Like I'd see it in computer stores. I could never get it. I think I had like a minor childhood crush on Razor.
Oh, I did too.
Yeah, I think a lot of people did. She was awesome. But never actually got to play it. By the time that I was able to get into adventure games when my parents upgraded us from an Apple II to a Mac in the early 90s, I was kind of more into Sierra's games like Space Quest and because they looked better than Maniac Mansion.
They did, yeah. And it's at least for me, it's I started with LucasArts and then later when I was a teenager, I would buy like the Sierra collections and I was like, yeah. I just can't get into these games because they play by very different rules. And
they were also better about porting them to Mac than LucasArts
for the
was.
Sierra, yeah. Anything else about the game?
I somehow missed it when I did play Day of the Tentacle. For the longest time, I was just kind of like, oh, yeah, I should play that someday. And this finally gave me the impetus to do that.
Awesome. Cool. We'll talk about what you thought about it soon. Jeremy, this is your favorite adventure game.
Yes, by far. that's not quite true. But it's not the only adventure game I've played. In fact, I felt really comfortable playing Maniac Mansion because I had already played through Shadowgate on NES.
Oh.
So it wasn't like, you know, unlike with Chris, or Phil, sorry. I wasn't like, oh, this is strange. Like this is, you know, a new form of video games for me. So I did feel kind of comfortable jumping into it. But yeah, I remember getting it like on a Black Friday when it first came out because my father went off to the store to buy – like do some gift shopping or whatever really early in the morning. I was like, well, if you see Ninja Turtles 2 or Maniac Mansion for NES, can you pick one of those up for me? And he came home with both because it was like buy one, get one free. So,
wow.
So that was a happy holiday.
Yeah, that's great.
But yeah, I played through Maniac Mansion quite a few times on NES and
with or without walkthroughs.
I don't know. I probably used a walkthrough. Mm-hmm. I don't remember like sitting there with a Nintendo Power, but I probably did use it to some degree like when I got stuck. But I liked the combinations of different characters and there were some characters I liked more than others. Like Jeff, I don't care. He's like the Fred from Scooby-Doo.
No, he's almost as useless as Dave.
He's just like some vanilla there.
Yeah.
Oh, is that his name, Dave?
Dave is the main character.
Oh, Dave, okay.
Who has no skills.
Which one is Jeff?
Jeff is a surfer.
Okay. Yeah, I don't care about
him. He's got the best music, though. Yeah.
But Bernard, I was like, yes, that's me. And then what's the name?
You are afraid of tentacles.
What's the name of the girl with the who's the journalist?
Wendy,
okay. Like those two characters were me. It was like the nerd and the writer. And then Razor I liked because she reminded me of a classmate of mine who was like punk rock and really cool and everyone was like, wow, she's awesome. I'm still friends with her on Facebook and she makes jewelry now out of like bones and
that's
skeletons
awesome.
And stuff. Yeah.
I think we all have
she's still rad.
She's still awesome, yeah.
We're all going to talk about our mutual Razor crushes in this room eventually. Yeah. But yeah, for me, it was sort of what I described earlier. I was a avid Nintendo Power reader and I saw this cover and I was like, this is like nothing I've seen before. You're just in a house. And you're like trying to rescue somebody, but you're not doing it by jumping on enemies. You're actually like interacting with in the environment in these detailed rooms. So it really that's when the bug bit me, and I eventually got it, and I was obsessed with it ever since. And I would like design my own adventure games on paper with friends. So like this game really got me into adventure games. We would not get a computer for like 6 more years. So like every day, every time I would go to like Software, etc., I would see all these adventure games on the shelf and just like start crying. Like I will never play these. I just want to play more adventure games. But eventually when we got a computer, I caught up with everything and I was much happier. But yeah, this game really planted that seed in my mind and I've been an adventure game fan ever since. And Let's talk about the goal of this game, the overall design of this game. So the goal of this game is very simple. The premise is very simple. Dr. Fred Edison, has kidnapped Dave's girlfriend, Sandy, for reasons. I guess his plot for her doesn't really make any sense in the grand context of the game. He's going to suck her brains out with the zombie Matic. It's important to notice to note that 25 years earlier, a meteor landed in the Edison's property, and it's been mind-controlling Dr. Fred ever since. And I guess cheerleader brains are part of his grand design. I don't know why. I don't know how that connects to anything. It's just a generic mad scientist plot, I think. Obviously, this game is inspired by B-movies and horror comedies and stuff like that. But looking at this game from, like, I guess a macro perspective or like just a pure design perspective, your goal is to rescue Sandy, but there are actually four goals you need to meet. Open both outer doors to Dr. Fred's lab, get past the purple tentacle, and then find a way to dispose of the evil meteor. And in order to do this, you have a team of three kids to pull off this goal or these goals. So you always have to have Dave. Dave is Sandy's boyfriend, and Dave has no skills, no abilities. And in fact,
he's the quintessential obligatory white guy.
I think so. He's like, well, he's based on Ron Gilbert in 1987. So I made the joke last time. It's like, was that a comment on you, Ron, that he doesn't have any skills? And I think Ron just frowned at me. But
my first playthrough, I just parked him in the dungeon and used him to free the other ones when they got caught.
That's all I do with him. And I think that's sort of I think the game is designed for him to get captured first, because when you go into the house, you go into the kitchen first, probably. It's the first door you see, and you're immediately captured by Edna. And once he's in the dungeon, there's no way to get out, so you have to send another kid in. So I think he's designed just to get captured.
I was always like, hey, Dave, why don't you go for a swim?
What's up? Oh, God. I do like his boys are back in town style music from the NES game, but that's basically it. So I'll talk about the rest of the characters and all of their skills. We can comment more on them if you want to. Bernard is Jeremy, obviously. He's the token nerd of the group. He has the most utility. He can fix anything. That means the radio and the phone. His one downside is that he cannot get past Green Tentacle. You have to have another kid get past Green Tentacle. He's the one that cannot even feed Green Tentacle. Once you get to the third floor, you have to give him food. Bernard doesn't even want to go there. He will just run away. So you need someone else to do that first. But that's not a big problem. That's really easy to do. So Bernard is kind of OP, I think, in this game.
Just
like Jeremy. He's OP for humanity. Jeff is the surfer and the stoner. He can fix the phone, but that's it. I mean, he's okay. Using the phone is helpful, but it's not necessary. And Jeff has cool music, but that's basically it. And he's on the cover. Some of the characters aren't on the cover. Razor, as we talked about, is the punk rock girl. She can play the piano and also microwave the hamster if you want to, which has no effect, but you can actually get one of the rare deaths if you microwave the hamster and give it to Weird Ed. He will kill you and bury you in the front yard, which is what happens to any kid who dies in the house. It's very, very morbid. So Sid is just the male copy of Razor. He does all the same stuff as her, and he can also microwave the hamster, I'm pretty sure. Wendy, she is the journalist. Her skill is being able to write anything, and that's used in this game by rewriting the meteor's
she
manuscript.
She has the best ending,
yes,
by far.
She can – oh, really, she does. I actually got it when I replayed the game. Apparently, she can rewrite like a 300-page manuscript in less than a night, which is great. Less than a few seconds in terms of the game's time. But the game operates on a really weird time flow in which you can send away for something. It will come on that same night. The mailman shows up. I have to assume this game takes place on one night. And I think the last character is Michael, who can develop film. And that's really just used to get past Purple Tentacle. If you develop the film for Weird Ed, he will help you get Purple Tentacle out of the way to access Sandy and Dr. Fred. So all of these character skills work to get you past the four, like, mini-goals under the main goal of rescuing Sandy. It's important to note that this has the point-and-click interface we all have grown to know and love in adventure games. Adventure games would eventually get rid of the verb bar. They would eventually move towards more like graphical icons. Thimbleweed Park, which is Ron Gilbert's newest game, uses the verb bar. He said, like, no, I like verbs. Further versions of this game would remove, like, four verbs. So verbs like fix, turn on, turn off, what is would be gone from the NES version and I think future versions. What is was kind of like a redundant.
It's not even a verb.
It's not
a
really.
Passive verb. Come on.
But it's not – it's kind of useless in that like in the original PC versions and in C64 versions, when you hover the cursor over something, it won't show you what it is in the little verb bar. But if you click what is and then hover, it does. In the NES version, you automatically get the what is. You know, what is built into the game itself. So they got rid of that being redundant. But over time, they pruned away a lot of the verbs and now all the essential ones are there in that final NES version. This game is also notable for sort of having an in-game clock. I'm not sure. I think it's just events or things you're doing that help things move along in time. I don't think it's like a real-time clock or anything sophisticated like that. But it does give the game a great sense of tension in that NPCs are moving around the house. You know, you cut to Dr. Fred as he's, you know, preparing to kill Sandy and things like that. It gives it a real sense of like momentum, like you have to hurry up. I don't think you can run out of time at any point in the game. You can sort of bumble around, but things are happening while you're doing things regardless of what your characters are doing. It's like things are happening and you're just in this world and trying to work around them.
The idea of NPCs having their own schedules independent of the player, had that been done before in video games? I mean that was something that you would see in like Shenmue and it was considered revolutionary there.
Yeah, I mean – once you strip away the artifice of Maniac Mansion, you realize it's like, well, Weird Ed only moves three times. Edna never moves and Dr. Fred never moves. So it's all sort of an illusion.
But, sure, but
but
still.
The tension is still there. But yeah, I mean –
I think this is part of why the game kind of eluded me so much as a kid is I – like this illusion, as you say, it totally worked for me as a kid.
Me too,
I was 100% like – that tension was there and I was like, this is a game where I can like run out of time or where like the people are moving around and it's not based off of – it. Like it really freaked me out as a kid.
And I think that was appealing to kids actually because weirdly enough, this game has a strange sense of like voyeurism, like especially for a kid whose life is controlled by all these forces outside of themselves. To be able to like sneak into a house and like creep around adults and know that they can catch you at any time, there's a sort of a weird thrill that you would get in major trouble for if you tried in real life as a kid. But there was sort of like a mischief simulator for children.
It does have that kind of Goonies element now that you sort of mention the kind of spiritual connection there of like creeping in and intruding into someone else's house where you're not supposed to be.
And as I talked about earlier, you know, when you're playing the game, it will cut away to different scenes like what Dr. Fred is doing, Weird Ed talking to his mom about Dr. Fred's plans, where characters are going and what they're doing. This game, I don't know if it invented cutscenes, but it invented the word cutscene. And in the scripting language of Maniac Mansion, it is CUT-SCENE. Phil, what is the polygon rules for the word cutscene? Yeah, is it one word, two words, hyphenated?
I'm really bad with our style guide.
I'm curious.
As editors, other editors at Polygon will tell you, but I think it is one word.
Okay, whenever I write it, I'm never sure.
I always just use it as one word.
Yeah.
Seeing it as hyphenated feels oddly old-timey, like photograph.
Yeah. Yeah, or like hello, or like tomorrow. I see that in a lot of old books.
Video hyphen game.
Yes.
That's like the biggest brain on the.
I just say juegos. It's much easier.
Juegos. Yeah.
No,
what is
juegos?
It?
Juegos is eggs.
Oh yeah,
that's
eggs.
A different thing.
Wait a minute.
Juegos rancheros.
Yes. I want beans poured all over my Maniac Mansion cartridge. Non-interactive story scenes existed prior to this, but I believe this was the first game in which scenes would cut away from the gameplay without the player's notice, without any sort of like, oh, you're now going to move to the story scene. It's just like you're in the middle of doing something. All of a sudden, you're cutting away to another scene. So this game sort of established this, and I think it was because it was created by people who didn't know the rules, really. It was just like, well, why can't we do this? I mean, like prior to this, non-interactive story scenes would happen before the game or after the game or both.
Is that how we justify Kingdom Hearts Dream Drop Distance, turning that into a mechanic where suddenly like you're in the middle of a boss battle and you have to play the other character instead?
Oh, God. I forgot about that.
Is that because Nomura doesn't know how video games work?
He should. He has no excuse. He's not Ron Gilbert in 1987. So And get ready for Final Fantasy VII Remake in 2025, everybody. So
it's very optimistic.
So excited.
Yeah. So we talked about the heroes of this game. Let's talk about the antagonists before we start getting into the actual design of the game. So the blue-skinned Edison family consists of a bunch of wacky characters. We have Dr. Fred. He's being controlled by the meteor, but some part of him is still self-aware because he leaves clues behind as to how to help him. So he puts the code for the second door in the Meteor Mess arcade game. I think he's crying for help on the inside, but he's being controlled by the meteor and he can't help it. Nurse Edna was the one character that really got a makeover for the NES game. She is always horny in a very sexually aggressive way.
Kind of getting you ready for Overwatch.
Yes, but it's not as great if an old lady is talking about tying you to her bed. So, yeah, that's what she says when she captures a male character. I should have tied you to my bed. And of course,
everybody is someone's fetish.
Yes, but I mean, Dr. Fred hasn't slept in 25 years, so he hasn't thrown her a bone in a long time, and there's a reason behind this. And I'm sorry.
What's the Nurse Edna fan art scene on Tumblr?
Oh boy!
Like?
Oh boy! I don't want to see that cosplay. I really don't. So Purple Tentacle is Dr. Fred's right hand man and his first line of defense. I don't know why Purple Tentacle allied with Dr. Fred, but Green Tentacle didn't. Green Tentacle, as we would see in these characters, would both move on to Day of the Tentacle. Green Tentacle is a wimp. His life is going nowhere. He wants to be a musician, and you have to feed him to get past the third floor into the fourth floor. That's a really easy thing to do. And he will eventually help you if you get him a recording contract, or he will kill you in two different ways. These are the two secret deaths in the game. Green Tentacle will kill you if you get a record contract for yourself. That's if you record yourself playing the music and then send away for a contract and show it to him. And disgustingly enough, he will also kill you if you record the tentacle mating call to a cassette tape and play it in his bedroom. It will just cut away from the room and then cut to your grave. So there's some things going on in Maniac Mansion that are not safe for anyone. This is I'm going to say this could be the one NES game with implied rape.
So that made it into the NES.
It's
version.
In the NES version. Wow. It must have slipped past something, someone.
It's probably just too subtle for the censors to
catch. It's like, oh, we just killed you because he was mad you ruined his record or something.
Well, it's you know, it's death by sex, but it's not a cross,
yes,
so it's okay.
I guess. But that somehow made it into the NES game, but Edna was less horny, even though she still had a heart-shaped bed with a mirror over it. And the purple meteor is constantly tripping purple slime. We don't know where he came from, but he has ambitions too, just like Green Tentacle. He wants to be a writer, but he sucks at writing, probably because he has no arms. I really want to
feel that. I feel that.
I mean, he's Dr. Fred's right hand man, but he has neither hands nor is he a man.
That's true. Yeah, but it's like
it's just a sad existence.
And you can find his memoirs in the mansion. That's how you get one of the endings. But it's just like, I want to read those. Like, where'd this guy come from? Why is he controlling this doctor's mind? There's so many questions I have, and there's no timeline or lore.
First playthrough, I tried to rewrite them as Razor, and
oh,
she's just like, oh, I think I made it worse.
I didn't know you could do that. That's great. Adventure games up to this point were notorious for killing the player, especially Sierra games, and in a way that feels a bit unfair in that the deaths were funny, but I feel like they punish you for experimenting. In LucasArts games, while they still had deaths, which they wouldn't last for very long, the deaths are sort of like Easter eggs that are obvious. Like, hey, don't fill the radioactive pool up with water if there's a kid in it. Don't give Weird Ed his exploded hamster remains. Like, don't push the self-destruct button on the mansion. These are all fun Easter egg things instead of, like, I walked to the right and a bear killed me or something like that, like in King's Quest.
Don't,
like,
microwave the water that you get from the radioactive pool.
That's true. Although it gives you a really cool scene of your character spinning around, apparently dying of radiation
poisoning. Did we talk about Weird Ed?
Weird Ed? Oh, you're right. Weird Ed is the military enthusiast who would now be posting on Reddit a lot, and he is really attached to his hamster. And his hamster is you must take his hamster to get the card key to the meteor's room.
Dr. Fred and Edna's kid, right?
He is, and he is not happy about his father, but he's also a weird shut-in.
He also looks like the sort of kid you'd keep in the basement in, like, the original concept art. Like, he's just wearing, like, a blood-spattered smock.
Oh,
and,
you're
like,
right.
Has this, like, weird long vulture neck.
He's much less ugly in the NES version. He's got, like, this weird bulbous chin and, like, these jagged teeth in
he
the computer
kind of
versions.
He has like a brown shirt Nazi uniform, though, doesn't he?
He does. It's like in, like, a little beret. Like, he's like a...
He's a survivalist.
Yeah. again, he would be posting on Reddit a lot. But yeah, again with the deaths, these are all like – I mean, I would stumble into some of these on the NES game, but they taught you something. But they were also funny, and you can save in this too, so it's not like you're being thrown back to the beginning of the game. And another thing about adventure games is that Sierra and other games, text adventures, basically everybody, they're all about these unfair dead ends. It's like you would do something to shut yourself off from finishing the game, but the game would not inform you in any way. So you'd just be bashing your head against things for a long time. And like with the deaths in Maniac Mansion, these dead ends are very obvious in some ways. I think there's maybe like one unfair dead end. And if you try to open the envelope, it will ruin it. And you need that envelope to do certain things in the game. You have to steam the envelope open to get a quarter out of it. There's one quarter in this entire mansion. And there are three dimes in this entire mansion you need, just like any good adventure game. But I want to move on to talk about the NES version. And I think this is the version that we all played first, right? I mean, I think, Michael, was it for you too, or was it Macintosh?
It was – well, actually, the version I played first was the one that's part of Day of the Tentacle Remastered.
Okay.
Which is the 1989 deluxe version, I think.
That's the MS-DOS version, yeah. But the NES version, as I said before, it has to be the most played version of the game. Based on just everyone on NES, the side of Nintendo Power Cover, it was like nothing anyone had played before outside of like Shadowgate. The graphics are a bit nicer. The characters maintain their very stiff animations. I mean, in no version of this game does walking up and down stairs look convincing. It's just like characters are oddly shuffling and moving sideways as they like – I don't know. I don't even know how to describe that.
It would take 3D games until like 2015 to create convincing stair animations.
I'm surprised they didn't just warp them to the next room when you click on the stairs instead of watching that like weird shuffle.
Yeah, they're shuffling their feet.
Yeah.
So strange.
It's like
they need some Simon Belmont animation.
It's like watching
– hunch up.
I was going to say it's like watching Donald Trump walk downstairs.
Yeah, it's also –
That's right. I said it.
It's also really striking like – comparing the NES version to the computer versions or of any game really, that NES games always had background music. PC games of the time almost never did.
Yeah, and so when I played the PC version much later, I was like, okay, this is the PC version of Maniac Mansion. It's going to be even better than the NES version. And then I was stunned to find out like, no, there's one song and it comes out of your PC speaker, as do all the other sound effects. And PC speaker is basically like the earliest cell phone trying to compose music.
Yeah, and it's mostly silent. There's very few sound effects.
Yeah, and I will say, like looking up some videos of the NES version in preparation for this podcast, one thing I had completely forgot was the music and how like it's actually pretty good.
It's
like,
good. It's produced by a group called Team Fat, who would produce a lot of very like European sounding music for the NES.
As in like the Fat Man?
The Fat Man.
The like, Seventh Guest?
As in Jake and the Fat Man?
No. I can't remember the guy's name. It's a game composer who calls himself the Fat Man.
It probably is him. Yeah.
Who's actually not fat, but like poses in nudie suits a lot. the cowboy tuxedos.
But yeah, this music is really good, and you'll hear it all throughout this episode. In an interesting touch, each character has a portable CD player, which is really fancy for 1990. I mean, that's a pricey item. And that CD player has a single looping song. And the song that plays – oh, George Sanger?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's the Fat Man. So each song the character has sort of defines them as a character. Like Jeff has like the surf rock sound. Bernard has this like crazy Devo. What would you call that? I mean, have you heard the Bernard song recently, Jeremy?
Not recently.
Okay, it's sort of
you're
like
– you're probably right, like new wave.
Like Devo, new wave. Razor's theme is really grating. It's like a punk theme. Michael has a jazzy theme. I think Wendy's theme is classical music, like sort of like a Bach ripoff. I mean, it's really great. It was a really nice touch. And you can turn this music off too if you want, so you can play the game as it was intended to be played originally. But it's a really, really nice touch. And I mean, you have to have a video game with music for the NES in 1990. You can't not do that. And there's also a lot of censorship in this game. We covered a lot of this in episode 77, but there is a great article on the internet that's been up since I've had internet access. It's called The Expurgation of Maniac Mansion. So if you read that, you will hear about all the things that Nintendo, you know, said this is – we will not allow this, including the word scum in the game.
Yeah.
Like NES scum system. Like why – we don't want the word scum next to NES, and they had to explain what that meant and everything. So go back to that episode. We'll talk more about that. But I did mention Edna is significantly less horny, which I think is good for all of us. And the NES version
– Not for me.
Not for Phil. He's pro-thirsty Edna.
Now we know the fetishist.
Wait, that's more of a waypoint attitude, Phil.
Yeah.
they're up to no good over there. So the NES version, one more thing, is it has some pretty significant bugs in it, one of which really helps you get past some challenges. So one of the best bugs in this game is that if you send one kid into, you know, Edna's room or Weird Ed's room, and before they get captured, you send another kid in, all the action in that room is frozen. So the other kid can just go around and loot the room and do whatever they want while the action is frozen. You'll still have that kid get captured, but you have all the time you want. So that is one cheat I always use in the NES version. So,
it's kind of like the Quicksilver scene in Days of Future Past.
Yes, exactly. It's like you have awesome like Zach Morris stop powers. You can just freeze time.
And it plays
and,
Rush.
And do whatever you want. And it was great to play the PC version because it's like I don't have this cheat anymore. Now I have to lure characters out of their rooms or call them on the phone or, you know, send a kid in to be the sacrifice. And then go into the room and try to make it out before they come back. It's all very tense, and that's what I love about this game. And there are some refinements. As I said, all the useless commands are gotten rid of. The what is thing is automatic. And in general, it is like just the best sort of in terms of ease of use, the best version of this game. I mean, unfortunately, you do have to play with a controller. But if you play it on ScumVM, there is a hack in which you can play it with a mouse. So you can actually play the NES version of this game with a mouse, which is amazing. I've never done it before, but I do want to try it. But if you want to play it now, this has never been re-released. I'm surprised there has never been a virtual console version of this game or anything like that with how popular it seemed to be. But there's no explaining.
I don't think LucasArts ever did anything with virtual console.
Really?
I don't think so. Hmm.
I don't think so. You're right.
The Super Star Wars games came out for the Super NES, but those were published originally by JVC, so I'm not sure what the rights are on those.
Well, this was published by Jalico.
Right.
And did they publish anything on Virtual Console, like Basis Loaded?
Jalico does publish on Virtual Console, but you know this is someone else's property, so you start getting into these weird rights collisions and things like that never show up.
Yeah. And the NES version was developed by one of the worst title developers, Real Time Associates, which I don't even know what that means, but
we associate with you in real time.
not in past time or, I don't know, active time battle.
They never made any turn-based game.
I see, yes.
It's always real time.
This would be their only good game. I mean, I look at their history and just like, well, I mean, you're making a good game even better, but this is a great version of this game.
And, what else did they make?
So we have, let's see, for the...
Well, they were around a while.
Yeah, they were around. They're still around. Founded in 1986. They're in El Segundo. NES games such as Caesar's Palace, Dick Tracy, The Rocketeer, and Team Fat did music for The Rocketeer, and I believe Dick Tracy. They did the Loom port for TurboGrafx-16. And
I played a lot of that Dick Tracy game. It wasn't good.
I did too. It was confusing. It reminded me a lot of Who Framed Roger Rabbit.
Yeah.
It wasn't good, but I have very fond memories for some reason.
I do too. They did the Beefs and Butted Super Nintendo game. I mean, do you need me to keep talking?
No, that's good. Okay. That's good.
I just want to know Pocahontas for the Pico. Everyone remember that?
Oh, wow.
They were
also
the
Pocahontas.
They were the creators of Bug and Bug 2. I mean, these guys wanted Bug to be their you know, meal ticket, but it never worked out. But they're still around.
I did play a lot of Bug also.
Wow. I've never played Bug.
I played – there was like a PC version of it that I had because I never had a Saturn.
Oh, there was a PC version of Bug. Bug, RIP. Pour one out for Bug at home, everybody. We'll be back after
when
this.
When is the Bug episode?
Oh, man. Bug episode is coming after you hit the next Patreon tier. $1 million. We will do an episode about Bug, but I'll leave you time to think about that. We'll be right back after our break.
You know, when you're a kid, there are a lot of things that you think exist. Unicorns, dragons, mermaids, you name it. When you're a kid, it's real. But when you find out later that they don't, well, it's kind of disappointing. Of course, as you get older, you get over the disappointment. But when you're looking to buy a car, there's nothing worse than finding the one of your dreams online, and then you find out later it doesn't really exist. It's not true. That's why at TrueCar, they show you real pricing on actual inventory. This isn't pricing offered to you by TrueCar. It's an actual VIN-based price from a TrueCar-certified dealer in your area. Real prices. And these aren't just any dealers either. TrueCar certified dealers are a carefully curated network of dealers committed to transparency. They offer competitive prices and a faster, easier buying experience for you. It's a fact. TrueCar customers are more likely to enjoy a faster buying process when they connect with the TrueCar certified dealers. And, on average, they save over $3,000 off the MSRP. So when you're ready to buy that dream car, visit TrueCar and enjoy a more confident car buying experience. Some features not available in all states.
The depiction of the U.S. Postal Service in Maniac Mansion is pretty remarkable, if unbelievable. Over the course of a single spooky night, multiple people can send and receive packages and without the use of any wormhole technology. That works great for solving adventure game puzzles, but unfortunately, the postal system in the real world is much more suited for our boring, puzzle-free world. But thankfully, you can still use it to access an incredible library of games via Gamefly. Gamefly is the best way to buy and rent all of your favorite games and have them mailed directly to your door. That's right, no more venturing out into an uncaring world for you. Now, there's a reason Gamefly is the leading video game rental service. With over 9,000 titles to choose from, Gamefly lets you try your favorite games and movies before you buy, and you can keep the games for as long as you want. Plus, you'll never have to worry about late fees, and you can cancel at any time. So if you want to check out Gamefly for yourself, go to gamefly.com/retronauts and start your free premium 30-day trial today. This premium trial allows you to check out two games and or movies at a time, and you can only get this offer by visiting gamefly.com/retronauts. Now go sign up and start playing all your favorite games absolutely free for 30 days.
The Serial Killer Podcast, hosted by me, Thomas Vyborg Thune, is the podcast dedicated to serial killers, who they were, what they did, and how. Join me as I sit down bi-weekly to bring you, dear listener, into the dark land of serial murder and psychopathy. The show goes into graphic detail on the most infamous and lesser-known serial killers from around the world, with each episode covering one unique serial killer. So far, the show has covered serial killer superstars such as BTK, Jeffrey Dahmer, and the Yorkshire Ripper, and lesser-known killers such as Elias Abuelazam and Anatoly Onoprienko. Be advised, this show is not for children, as it takes you deep into the twisted world of ultimate evil. You can find me exclusively at podcastone.com or on the new Podcast One app. Also, don't forget to rate and review on Apple Podcasts.
And now, an important message from Maniac Mansion.
I'm here to talk to you about a serious problem that's developed, and that is, we found out that people are attempting to imitate Turner, my oversized four-year-old son, and Harry, my brother-in-law, who's a fly, by trying to mutate themselves. Now, people, please, do not mutate yourselves at home. It's very dangerous.
What's he talking about? Maniac Mansion, a daringly witty look at the far side of family life. You've met Fred, the oblivious head of household. Then there's Casey, his wife.
Is there a law that says a mother can't be snippy with her own kids?
Speaking of the kids, Ike's got a James Dean fixation. Tina's a true teenage genius. And Turner's the baby of the family, mutated into a baby Huey. Plus, there's Uncle Harry, the hapless house fly.
Oh, that'd be good for a few laughs.
Time magazine calls Maniac Mansion the looniest, sweetest family comedy of the year. The best of 90. See it here on Fridays, Saturdays, and Sundays, only on the Family Channel.
And caller number 9 for $1 million. Rita, complete this quote. Life is like a box of...
chocolates.
Rita, you're cutting out. We need your answer.
Life is like a box of chocolates.
Oh, sorry. That's not what we were looking for. On to caller number 10.
Bad network got you glitched out of luck? Switch to Boost Mobile's super reliable, super fast nationwide network and get 4 lines, each with unlimited gigs for just $100 a month. Plus, get 4 free phones. Boost makes it easy to switch. Switching makes it easy to save.
So we're back from our break, and I wanted to point out that if you heard commercials and do not like hearing commercials, I'm only saying this because I had to point this out to people on our Twitter account, and they were very happy after I told them. If you go to our Patreon at patreon.com/retronauts, for $3 a month, you get all of our podcasts a week ahead of time at a higher bitrate and with no ads. I'm only saying this because I've seen people online upset about the ads, and I just was like, hey, this is how you get no ads, and they're very happy after I tell them that. So,
and it really doesn't count as listening to my voice unless you're listening at the highest possible bitrate.
That's true. You need to hear all of the true fill of it, not with all, you know. We have to downgrade things a bit.
I love you.
Yeah, woo.
I'm saying it to the audience.
If you're you're on Patreon, that was a special gift to everybody. So just letting you know, patreon.com/retronauts. I think I'm going to let everyone know after the break because, I mean, ads are how we're trying to make this thing grow into a real business. And unfortunately, some people don't like hearing them, but we do offer an option if you don't. But let's stop talking about the world of capitalism and more about Maniac Mansion. I did want to talk about the overall design of this game. I think I've sort of given it in broad strokes, but for being a first-time adventure game designer, there's a lot of sophistication in what Ron Gilbert did with this game in that, well, number one, the entire mansion is not available to you at once. It gradually opens up, which is a very interesting design choice, and it is put in there to not intimidate players. Some of the things you would see get improved in his games are in Maniac Mansion, there's a lot of I would call it chaff. There's a lot of items that have no use. It's just like, I'm going to pick up the rotting turkey. I'm going to pick up the old batteries. A lot of them are just like, you can pick this up. It's fine. Like, there's a lot of things like that in the game. But I really want to know from you guys, if you can remember, can you remember any specific puzzles that you got stuck on in the game, maybe from childhood or anything you couldn't figure out? Like, how do I do this? Or when do I do this? Like, anything stick out in your mind?
I still haven't figured out what the small key in Edna's room is
for. Ooh, I can tell you the small key opens up the coin boxes on the arcade games. In case you play the wrong one, you can get your quarterback because only one quarter exists in the world of Maniac Mansion. Jeremy or Phil, can you remember any like puzzles or anything, like any times you got stumped in the game?
Yeah, the one involving timing, like getting a kid into Edna's room and having him captured. Like that was pretty tough.
Yeah. How about you, Phil? Do you know any
Yeah, nothing's popping into my mind. It's been long enough that I'm not sure I remember any specific puzzles.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of anything. I feel like they were just like a bunch of random scattershot ones. Nothing in particular, but just like, I don't know how to open this door. But this game, I feel, more than adventure games, I mean, every adventure game was meant to be replayed, but Maniac Mansion is such a short game that I feel like it's sort of a Groundhog's Day sort of effect where it's just like, I have to be outside to get the package, because if you don't get the package, you can't befriend Weird Ed. I have to be at this location at this time or this thing won't happen. A lot of this game involves mailing things. So you have to if you want to get the ending with Razor or Sid, you have to record the Green Tentacles demo track, send it away, then wait outside, get the contract and everything like that. There's a lot of things involving time in this game where you have to know where to be.
Is this why you love Majora's Mask so much? You were conditioned from childhood to love Majora's Mask?
I think this game introduced me into the idea of games where the illusion of the game will move on without you. Like, you are just in this world and things are happening and you need to react to them. Like, I'm a big fan of any game that's like that. I don't know about you guys. I like feeling that I'm not like the all-knowing God. I'm just this person in this world that's going to do whatever it wants to without me.
Yeah, you know, I'm thinking about it now from the Majora's Mask perspective, and I think we had the kind of like opposite reaction where, like I said, it worked for me in terms of being incredibly tense, but I hated it. And then similarly with Majora's Mask, I was just like, no. I think it like conditioned me to hate that kind of thing in video games, or like to be really like put off by it.
Thankfully, in Maniac Mansion, there's no end time limit, I think. Something really weird happened to me as a kid, and I did not dream this, and I can't find anything about it online. It might have been just the game locking up because of a bug and not letting me do anything. But I was just experimenting with the game as a kid, and all of a sudden, none of the characters could move. And when I tried to do something, the only text I got was, "The meteor is in control now." And that was a terrifying thing to me as a kid. And searching for that online, I could not find anything about it. I have no idea where that error message came from or if it's something that happens if you take too long in the game. But I don't think this game has a hard time limit or – I mean, it acts as if it does. At some point in the game, Dr. Fred turns off the power, and that sort of is like one of the final events that happens without your intervention, like something that happens, a cutscene. And if you're fast enough, you can repair the wires in the attic to fix the arcade game in order to get that working. Otherwise, you can turn them off yourself. But I don't think that this game has a time limit. I just think it's all an illusion. But as Phil was saying, and certainly I had that feeling too as a kid, like it works. It's like you have to keep moving. Things are happening in this mansion, even though they really aren't. It's all an illusion.
I did read something about that. The meteor is in control now thing seems familiar to me, but I can't remember exactly what triggers it.
What if the secret twist at the end of this episode of Retronauts is that the meteor has been in control ever since that point in your life? And you just didn't know it.
I'm like, it's just like the plot of Get Out, but with a meteor. Someone put a meteor in my brain. Spoilers for Get Out, by the way. Please see it. let's move on to talk about strangely enough, the very different version of this game. This game was unavailable for about, I'm going to say, 20 years. Unavailable in any format as it was not republished. I think LucasArts republished it up until probably the early 90s or mid-90s. It was always available on Day of the Tentacle, but I think Day of the Tentacle went out of print in like 1996. But there's – as I said, there are many versions we talked about before. But because it was unavailable, people did try to remake it. So we have the version that I played a lot in the aughts was Maniac Mansion Deluxe. It was an unofficial remake that updates Maniac Mansion, and it looks more like a LucasArts game from the Monkey Island era. It's a very nice looking game. I don't know where you can get it now. It was free, obviously, but it was a very nice upgrade of the PC version. There's no music, of course, because that's what it was trying to emulate, the PC version. We also have Meteor Mess 3D, which has been in development for like 6 years. I saw a Kotaku story about it. I don't know, a long time ago, maybe 2011, but it doesn't look good. It's like all of the characters are very Sims looking. They look like Sims models, so you lose a lot of the character. I don't know if you guys have seen Meteor Mess 3D or anything like this.
I have. It's not the most attractive looking game.
I don't think it will ever be finished. I feel like people eventually forgot about it. But the best one, which I think will also not be finished, but it looks the best, is Night of the Meteor, which is a remake done in the style of Day of the Tentacles. So they're redoing the characters and backgrounds and things as if they were very Chuck Jones looking Day of the Tentacle characters, and they do a very good job. What I've seen of it, but it's been in works for 6 years, and the last update to the webpage I think was in 2016. So with a lot of these ambitious projects, you see people just give up, which is understandable. Like making a full remake of a game, even as small as Maniac Mansion, is a pretty big undertaking. But thankfully you can play this game today, as Michael was saying, on 2016's Day of the Tentacle Remastered, which is the way I played it.
I played it on PS4.
Ooh, on PS4. Wow. Wow, I can't imagine. Yeah, it's like, can you imagine what? Yeah, but if you go to Weird Ed's room and use the computer, you can play Maniac Mansion, and it's a great version of the game. No music, but it is the, you said it's like the deluxe version, like the IBM PC version.
Yeah, the 1989 version.
Yeah, yeah, it looks really good. Much better than the Commodore 64 version, which looked pretty good for a Commodore 64 game in 1987, but it's not very great today. And I think that IBM PC version might have the first true version of the Maniac Mansion theme. The C64 version has just the bass line, really, and the drums. But this version would have like the melody on top of it. And the NES version is the best. You'll hear it probably at some point in this. But it's Team Fat with their crazy like European-style chip tunes doing the Maniac Mansion theme, and it's great. And one thing I have to bring up is the inexplicable – that's the best way to describe this TV show.
Yes.
Canadian-American co-production. Everyone's shaking their head or maybe nodding in solidarity for – we all experienced this and suffered through this. 1990 to 1993, 66 episodes of Maniac Mansion, and I'll tell you what.
That's so many more than I had – assumed they
ever did. I thought it was like 13 and they were out, Phil. But yeah. Young Bob was never disappointed more. This is coming from someone who doesn't have a father, by the way. Young Bob was never disappointed more than watching the show Maniac Mansion for the first time and realizing this was not what was promised to me. This is not a Maniac Mansion TV show. So what do you guys remember of the show before I talk more about it? I just remember it's like, they're making a Maniac Mansion TV show. They interviewed Joe Flaherty in Nintendo Power. Of course, all the kids know about SCTV. This is going to be great. And then I watch it. I'm like, what the hell is this? Anybody jump in with Maniac Mansion TV show memories?
Dr. Fred wasn't blue.
That's true. He was not blue, number one.
And much younger than his video game counterpart. But I watched this, rewatched it recently for an episode of VGA that we were doing on.
Oh, like, where did you find it? Michael, just on YouTube or something?
Yeah, just
on
YouTube.
Yeah. This was never released on like DVD. Like, who is going to buy the Blu-ray of Maniac Mansion?
Like, first off, while researching.
Phil pre-ordered it.
While researching for this, I kept having that stupid theme song running through my head, which is kind of pretty but totally inappropriate.
Oh, yeah.
To something called Maniac Mansion. And then, like, the actual show, I could only get through about 5 minutes before shutting it off because, like, oh, this is like every dumb sitcom where it's like focused – they have like two and a half kids that are always like taking pot shots at each other and laugh track with every joke a kid tells. And
I mean, I
vaguely recall, and like I don't know if I'm making this up because I don't remember the show very well. Was it supposed to be like a take on like Addams Family's?
Yeah, I kind of feel like you had the Munsters, which was the it was the bad version of the Addams Family. Then this was the bad version of the Munsters.
Yeah, I mean it was the – I mean so they only keep Dr. Fred. And there's also an uncle who's a fly. He's like the
– He's a human head on a fly ball.
Yeah. So there's some special effects. And there's also just like – it's. I don't think it's very funny. Just like a giant baby Huey style adult. But it's just like sort of like a developmentally disabled person. It's just like this giant child – this giant man has the brain of a child. I was like, well, that's actually like not that outlandish. This is not very sci-fi. So but it doesn't even go that far.
Since you bring up the Munsters, I just thought like it felt less like that and it felt more like what they really wanted to do was a Honey, I Shrunk the Kids TV series.
Yeah.
And they got this license instead.
I mean, they eventually made one. But I want to compare two things here because we have some time to kill. And that's the most important thing on Retronauts is to kill time. Let's compare Maniac Mansion's theme to the TV show theme. So I friggin' love Maniac Mansion's theme, especially the NES version. Let's play a bit of it. So we get this kickin' ass drum. Oh, it's so good. I mean, we're all on board with this, right?
Yeah. No,
yeah.
It's good.
Yes.
Yeah,
it's
good.
It's exciting. Things are happening.
I love it. Man, this is the most rockin' NES song I think ever produced. So you've heard the Maniac Mansion NES theme. Let's hear the heartwarming season one intro of Maniac Mansion. Yeah, I'm really thinking about, Purple Meteor and Razor and, Tentacles.
I beat a PlayStation game in 1998 that had this as the ending theme.
I want to – hold on. They actually say Maniac Mansion at some point here.
Yeah, it's in the chorus.
Let's skip ahead. Maniac I mean, I'm getting goosebumps but for different reasons. That's Maniac Mansion.
You destroy Metal Gear and you ride off with Hal into the sunset on a snowmobile, and that's the music
line. That's it.
It's beautiful. But yeah, I mean, it's again,
like Symphony of the Night, the castle's crumbling. And
I am the wind. I am the mansion. Yes. Yeah, so that, I mean, that was one of the most devastating moments of my life is watching. I've lived a very charmed life, by the way. But watching Maniac Mansion for the first time was just like, why did they do this? And
did you stick with it? Did you keep watching?
No. I mean, I would watch any garbage on TV at that time. I would watch that wretched Mario cartoon. All three of them. I would watch anything involving a video game, but I was like, "This has gone too far, sir," and I will not even tolerate this for a second. And it's funny because it involved a lot of talented people. I mean, it involved people from SCTV. A lot of Joe Flaherty's great. He's the if you don't know who he is, he's the guy at the end of Back to the Future 2. Are you Marty McFly? He's that guy. I mean, he's done a lot more than that. He played Count Floyd on SCTV. He's great. I mean, he's okay in this too. He was also the dad on Freaks and Geeks, the dad of the main geek. But
I wonder if anybody's ever done like a deep dive on how this show happened and like what the story is behind it.
It's funny you mentioned that because like I brought this up to Ron Gilbert and Tim Schafer. And they're very polite about it, but they kind of had like a WTF reaction to it as well, where they were like, yeah, they were just producing this thing and they told us about it and we watched it and we were like, what, did they play the game? I feel like Maniac Mansion fever was hot in 1990 because the NES game was out, and Maniac Mansion is a very compelling name. I think that's really what sold the game, the title Maniac Mansion. But I just think they just wanted the premise, and not even the premise, just like the title and the mansion and the doctor, and that's it. I don't think they cared about the actual guts of the game. But as a kid, I was like, oh, every week they're going to break into the mansion and solve puzzles, and it's going to be great. But it's like heartwarming family, and there's a fly guy, and yeah, that's basically it. so we must, before we go, let's talk about the Famicom version. It's unfortunate. I think we're talking about it earlier. Were you talking about it, Phil? Or,
I mentioned it.
Yeah, it's so this version was by Jalico, and luckily they did not port this over to America. Jalico got Real Time Associates to make their own version. I think they sort of acknowledged their mistakes. It's very bad. Ugly graphics. Everybody in this game looks like a little play school action figure that just like they're all smiling and they're just all like very squat and super deformed.
That aspect somehow feels more appropriate to Japan at the time.
It really does, but I think it removes the sort of creepy vibe of the creepy, spooky, fun vibe, the spoopy vibe, if you will.
Yeah,
of
I mean, that sort of aesthetic makeover worked a lot on NES, Famicom. Like you kind of make it sort of cute Japanese cartoon style. And generally, Japanese developed NES games were better than, you know, Western developed NES games. But I think there was such strength in the original material that did not work out in one of those kind of rare exceptions to the rule.
Yeah, and I can tell you more about the limitations. So like one of the more technologically advanced things in Maniac Mansion for the Commodore 64 is they had scrolling rooms, which is like, oh my god, we can scroll a room and you can walk to the end of the room and there could be something waiting for you on the other end. It was like something to build suspense in the game. In the Famicom version, almost every room is condensed into one screen and they get rid of a lot of the items in the screen. If you look at this game screenshots of it, and I suggest you do if you want to know what we're talking about, everything looks very plain. Every room is just very stark primary colors. All the objects you can interact with are just there. It just – I mean it doesn't feel like you're in a real house, like a real spooky house. It just feels like very artificial and very gamey in a way, in a bad way. There's no music and unfortunately there's no save system. You have 104 character passwords, so that's almost like a tweet these days. So like not an ideal version of Maniac Mansion. Again, Real Time Associates did a great job for one of their only good games, and that is the one I had Ron Gilbert sign, even though he's like, I didn't work on this.
They had to get the experts on it. They had to call up the bug people.
It's like,
hi. The future bug people.
Are you associates? Question number two, do you work in real time? You're hired. So I want to move on before we go to talk about Day of the Tentacle. Now, who here is familiar with this game in this room? I am. Michael, have you played Day of the Tentacle?
Of course, yes.
Phil and Jeremy, how about you guys?
Afraid not.
God damn it, Jeremy. Well, we can talk without you.
You told me to play Maniac Mansion.
I know,
just
kidding.
You didn't say anything about Day of the Tentacle.
I'm just kidding. Mm-hmm. I'm just kidding. That was not discussed ahead of time. But Day of the Tentacle was a game made by Ron Gilbert's proteges, Dave Grossman and Tim Schafer, of course. And it is a fantastic game. I like it more than Maniac Mansion. I am probably the biggest fan of Day of the Tentacle that ever lived. If you look at – I really suggest you go to my US Gamer oral history of Day of the Tentacle. It is probably the hardest I've ever worked on something, and I don't know how many people read it, but it is about 40,000 words of the development of Day of the Tentacle. I talked to everyone who worked on the game, both directors, the musician, the art people. It is a really great look, I think, into the development of this game. And I think I have the most Wikipedia citations on this game now, which is my goal in life. I will have no children, but I will have Wikipedia citations, and that's more important. But this game really it tries to stay canonical to Maniac Mansion in some ways, in that what happened in the first game was made into a game, which is the game we played. Mm-hmm. But this is the reality of Maniac Mansion. The Day of the Tentacle is the reality of the Maniac Mansion world. The game we played was based on the events of the real world. And a lot of this game is based around how screwed Dr. Fred gets on the TV series and the video game. Like he signed a bad contract, and a lot of this game is about getting him out of that contract.
Was the contract with three guys who publish anything, or is it somebody else? I forget.
Somebody else. I forget who. I don't think they were represented in the game. But this game would only carry over Bernard, but a lot of the other residents of the mansion are there. Purple Tentacle is the antagonist. Dr. Fred, Nurse Edna is in there briefly. A Weird Ed is in the game, and the funny way they characterize him is that it's canonical that his hamster was killed by one of the kids, so he now is a very tortured man who works on a stamp collection. That's and
a voice kind of based on Boris Karloff.
Yes, it's like, how has Boris Karloff talked? Like,
Something happened to him.
I was working in the lab. That's really it, right?
Just say antipasto.
Okay, that's right.
That's your Boris Karloff impression.
Very nice, but I feel like this game. is not very faithful to the Maniac Mansion formula, and I don't think any game would be as ambitious in terms of giving you seven characters to play with. That was only in place because Tim and Ron and Gary didn't know what they could do. They didn't know their limitations. But Phil, what did you think of this game compared to Maniac Mansion? I'm just curious.
Yeah, like I said, I played this back to back with as a teenager when I finally went back and finished Maniac Mansion. I played this immediately afterwards, and I like this game a lot more. Obviously, it's made like years later, so it's got like a lot more polish and everything.
Yeah, it's much more sophisticated too in terms of design and stuff like that.
But also, I just feel like the writing is a lot sharper and funnier.
Yeah,
not that Maniac Mansion's writing is like horrible by any means, but it just feels better here.
There's not a lot formative.
It is. I mean, there's not a lot of writing and dialogue in Maniac Mansion.
Yeah.
I mean, I think Adventure Games would get a lot of free jokes in by including like a look at command where characters would describe an object, and you don't get that for a lot of objects in Maniac Mansion. There's no look at. There's read, and very few objects can be read. So they didn't work in too many jokes like that. But you get a lot of extra writing when you have commands like that, and you have voice acting, and characters can say more, and you have more characterization that way. Michael, how did you feel about this game?
Well, initially, I remember being kind of disappointed that it didn't carry over the you can pick three characters from a pool of seven thing from Maniac Mansion. But really, like going back and playing the original, all that means is that like you have two different sets of puzzles that you have to do, either one of which will get you past the purple tentacle at the end of the game.
Yeah.
So it's not really that big an innovation. It just kind of seems that way. But I really enjoyed Day of the Tentacle. I loved the writing. I kind of liked that Bernard went from being like a 1950s style nerd to just being like this slouchy, I'm Bernard Bernoulli.
And he's voiced by Les Nessman from WKRP in Cincinnati.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Oh, yeah?
He really is, yeah. Yeah, this game I feel is I feel like adventure games are unfairly maligned. I mean, I would say 10% of them are worth playing just because of all these design problems. But I feel like Day of the Tentacle has aged very well. Yeah. There are no dead ends. I feel the puzzles are logical, and it has one of the best implementations of a time mechanic I've ever seen in a game. It's sort of like this and Chrono Trigger are still the gold standard. Nothing else has really topped those two games for me in terms of how they use time as a mechanic. Like in this game, the things you do in the past directly affect the future, and you can send things through time, and that affects how the item changes and things like that. Like I feel like this game has a very good use of time travel that I don't see in a lot of other games. Like Final Fantasy XIII-2, that was just I enjoyed that game, but the time travel element was just like confusing and not implemented very well. I can't even remember what it did, but it just was like
I forgot that game had time travel involved.
It's like you're in the past, except instead of brown mountains, they're now purple, and that's it. It's like there's two new NPCs. I don't know. I just realized we didn't talk about the various endings, and Jeremy mentioned Wendy's ending is the best. Michael brought this up when we recorded Video Game Apocalypse a few days ago. That so there are a number of –
this must have been like one of the earliest games with multiple endings, right?
Yeah. There are –
I mean it's just based off the character you choose, but
– I think there are five or six, and only a few of them are tied into specific characters.
Oh.
So Wendy's ending is if you rewrite the Purple Meteor's – not Purple Meteor's, just the Meteor's memoirs – instead of wanting to take over the world, he is now a successful writer. And the last thing you see is him on David Letterman giving an interview.
He calls Wink. And it's like, I don't think Wink Martindale ever hosted a talk
show.
No,
but I mean at least on the PC version, the host has like a gap in his teeth.
So you can, and he's got a jar of pencils.
Yeah, and the cityscape behind him and everything like that. So that's one of the endings. Another ending is – so there are various ways to get rid of the Purple Meteor. and you can have him arrested by the Meteor Police. And that's one of the endings you can get with Bernard. You need Bernard to fix the radio to radio the Meteor Police. And Michael was telling me, I forgot about this. You can get the purple – you can get the Meteor, his writing contract, but also call the Meteor Police, and he's arrested on the talk show. That's great. I forgot about that completely.
I did that.
I called the Meteor Police, and then like you have to wait like 5 or 6 minutes for him to show up. And like I just finally said, you know what? Screw this. I just want to finish the game. So I went through and did Wendy's thing, and then yeah, the guy just shows up in the middle of the talk show.
That's great. I love that. So I feel like only two endings are specific to characters. So like Bernard has can fix the radio, and Wendy can rewrite the memoirs. But getting the recording contract for Green Tentacle only gets you past Purple Tentacle, I think. He will come in and like push him out of the way. That's basically all it does, is doesn't affect the ending. You can put the meteor in the trunk of the Edsel and blast it off into space, and I think that's it. But you can also there's also different endings if you kill one of the kids, especially Dave. If you kill Dave, the ending is pretty funny. But if you kill one of the other kids, I don't think they comment on it very much. Like Sandy is not happy when Dave's grave is in the front yard. And when you kill someone, it's kind of a great morbid little joke. When you kill someone and you can still switch to their character, but all you see is their grave and it's just like I can't reach it. Like if you try to click on anything, it's like I can't reach it. So clearly there's some sort of consciousness happening there. But who knows if they were buried alive. I don't know. But yes, that was our Maniac Mansion episode. I hope you all enjoyed it. And thank you so much, Phil, for coming to our studio for the first time.
Yeah,
and,
thank you for having me. I'd love to come back anytime.
I think you might have been on – I'm trying to think of other Retronauts you've been on. If you want to go back in time, 9 years.
Yeah, I remember being on a Half-Life episode.
That's right. Yeah. That
many,
was probably
– many moons ago.
2008 or something like that. Yeah. So yeah, Phil has been on now 2 episodes. So hopefully he'll come back. This was a great chat. And let's wrap up. You can find me on Twitter as Bob Servo. And my other podcast is Talking Simpsons every Wednesday on the Laser Time Podcast Network. Go to TalkingSimpsons.com and find that, or look for Talking Simpsons in your podcast machine. Every week is a new episode of the show. We're going in chronological order. I'm guessing we'll be in season 6 by the time this episode launches. We've had the great Bill Oakley on our show. He is the showrunner for season 7 and 8, and he's written a lot of great episodes before that. So yeah, check out Talking Simpsons. Find an episode you like and download our corresponding episode. You should enjoy it. Everyone else, where can we find you? Phil?
I am at Twitter.com/pkohler, and I am on polygon.com. I review a lot of video games, so if you ever go to our review section, there's a pretty good chance you'll find something I wrote.
Cool. And Michael?
I'm on Twitter at wikiparas, and I host a weekly podcast also on the Laser Time Network called Vigigame Apocalypse that is very loose and crude compared to this show and its stringent control of facts.
I have total control of facts.
But that goes up every Friday.
This is not fake news, by the way. And who else is here? Jeremy.
Oh, it's me, Jeremy Parrish. You can find me on Twitter as GameSpite. And, of course, you can find me at Retronauts, because that's what I'm doing, Retronauts.
Awesome.
Retronauts.com.
And I should mention our Patreon. It's very important that we mention that, because it's how Retronauts is supported. Thanks to all of you out there, we're able to do things like bonus episodes. We have two micros a month now, so now we do 6 episodes every month.
They're not really micros anymore.
No, they're like 45 minutes long.
Yes,
I'm trying to make them smaller. I swear, I talk too much. But yeah, if you go to patreon.com/retronauts, you can find out how to give to our show. If everybody just gave us $1 a month, we could just do amazing things. But if you want to give more, there are incentives on top of that. As I said earlier, $3 a month gets you every episode a week ahead of time at a higher bitrate and with no ads. So if those ads have you gritting your teeth and being mad at us talking about underwear and pillows and things like that, well, this is your way out of those ads, and you can get a higher quality podcast with that tier. But there's more tiers on top of that, including things like t-shirts and zines and things like that. So go to patreon.com/retronauts for more about that. And that's the end of our show. Thanks so much for listening. We'll be back next week with a brand new episode.
And caller number 9 for $1 million. Rita, complete this quote. Life is like a box of...
chocolates.
Rita, you're cutting out. We need your answer.
Life is like a box of chocolate.
Oh, sorry. That's not what we were looking for. On to caller number 10.
Bad network got you glitched out of luck? Switch to Boost Mobile, super reliable, super fast nationwide network, and get four lines, each with unlimited gigs for just $100 a month. Plus, get four free phones. Boost makes it easy to switch. Switching makes it easy to save.
The Mueller Report. I'm Ed Donahue with an AP News Minute. President Trump was asked at the White House if Special Counsel Robert Mueller's Russia investigation report should be released next week when he will be out of town.
I guess from what I understand, that will be totally up to the Attorney General.
Maine's Susan Collins says she would vote for a congressional resolution disapproving of President Trump's emergency declaration to build a border wall, becoming the first Republican senator to publicly back it. In New York, the wounded supervisor of a police detective killed by friendly fire was among the mourners attending his funeral. Detective Brian Simonson was killed as officers started shooting at a robbery suspect last week. Commissioner James O'Neill was among the speakers today at Simonson's funeral.
It's a tremendous weight to bear, knowing that your choices will directly affect the lives of others. But cops like Brian don't shy away from it. It's the very foundation of who they are and what they do.
The robbery suspect and a man police say acted as his lookout have been charged with murder. I'm Ed Donahue.